is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. Kate Mildenhall, mid-book tour.
Hello, Catherine Collette.
You've had 3 days off, though.
I have been relaxing. There has been sunshine. It's been a sunshine-adjacent relaxing time, which is really awesome. And I spent some of it in bed, I'm going to freely admit.
My God.
Also, how good is that? Chowing down on some kale shakes. Mm-hmm. Not something I thought I'd ever admit to on this podcast. Oh, can't really taste the kale.
It's an underwhelming end to.
I know.
You're going to say something nice. Like,
they
wow.
are nice. If you put enough other things in there, it just makes it look very brown when you have to. It just doesn't look so appealing to drink.
I am still from that bloody juice cleanse in COVID, of which I did more than one. I still have all these jars in my room that I, because they were meant to pick up the jars when they dropped off a second one, but they didn't do that. I think they didn't do that twice. But so also, I'm still sort of putting them in the recycling bin and feeling horribly guilty.
It's a marketing ploy too, right? Because then you feel like I've got to get the boxes picked up, so I'll just have to do it again. Yeah. Oh, no. My kale shake has way more things in it than just water.
Oh, my God. The dismalness of celery juice is like.
People are going to think that we have shifted it up into health and wellbeing after starting with ice baths last week and now going on to kale smoothies. There have been other interesting things in my life.
Well, probably your life is a bit more interesting at the moment. So let's start with you. Book tours.
Book tours.
What has life looked like these past, what date did the book come out?
It came out
1st of August?
Yes, good. 1st of August, which is now
a bit under 6 weeks, something like 5 weeks. What does the 5 weeks look like?
Fairly chaotic. If I could paint you a picture of my house, I won't because it's traumatic. But basically the good old yellow suitcase, which has had its fair share of social media time because of all its dilemmas along the way, has remained in a state of semi-pack for a lot of that time, which is probably annoying everyone in the house. Like I, you know, get some things out, put some new things in, whatever. I have to say that having a range of clothes prepped for the length of the tour was smart. So Thank you, Shay.
Did you actually plan out the full
tour,
or you just sort of a week?
I knew there was enough stuff, you know, to get me through. It has been fairly chaotic. And wonderful. I think I posted this at some point last week, that one of the things about being on tour that is really delightful is the stories that you hear from readers or booksellers, or like there's been, you know, tears in a bookshop with a reader and a bookseller. And then there have been some great
about a book
stories.
Or about?
Yeah, just about the conversation that came up while we were discussing books and life.
Yeah.
And then just great stories. Lots of hugs, you know.
Do you write any of those stories down?
I've taken a lot of random notes in my phone, and when I look back, I have no idea what they relate to. For instance, let me tell you a good story, which I know that you will enjoy, and I'm pretty sure that Charlotte from Ink Bookshop will let me share this because it's public knowledge, although I didn't know it. So last week I had an event at the Ink Bookshop in Mansfield, which was bloody delightful. And also Mansfield was like, it was a sunny day. The sun was setting as I was driving into town, rolling green hills. You know, there was wine. The Mansfield folk were all amazing. And to top it all off, the delightful Charlotte and her family had offered me digs for the night so that I could stay at their beautiful home. And they cooked for me, all of which was delightful.
In their house?
In their house. Yeah,
oh my
beautiful
God, that's
house.
So generous.
So generous. I mean, I could have been a madwoman. Who knows? I could have been an axe murderer. Probably not, because I've, you know, too much of a profile for that, maybe.
It's not the perfect crime, is it?
It's not the perfect crime. Anyway, we're going to talk about crime in a second because of this podcast that I'm listening to. Anyway, Charlotte just drops into conversation, just like she had no idea what impact this would have on me, that she is the girl that John Marsden based the character of Ellie in Tomorrow When the War Began on. So much what? So that she's in the acknowledgements and she was on the Australian story about John Marsden.
What?
Right? I couldn't concentrate on any other conversation for at least an hour, and then I had to send follow-up messages the next day just saying, this has blown my mind and the mind of my sister and all the people I know who love Tomorrow When the War Began. Like, this is next level. Can you believe it?
How did she know John Marsden? Or did she not know John Marsden?
No, she did. She was at she boarded where he was like the she came from. I think her family's from regional New South Wales or Queensland, can't remember the details. And as an 11-year-old, she came down to board at the place where John Marsden was like head of the boarding house. And then later on, she was a student of his in his English class. How cool is that?
Is that weird on some level, though? How does she know it was her?
I don't know. They've talked about it. She's in the book. It's like, I don't know if it's dedicated to her. I can't find my copy because Gracie's stolen it and taken it to school. But yeah, it's totally her. It's her.
Have an experience camping or something? Like how?
No, I didn't get into those details.
Do you think that's odd on some level?
I didn't feel it was odd, but I'm going to go and follow up. Charlotte, if you're listening to this, I'm coming. Catherine has questions, so you may in fact get an invite. But it's stories like that, you know, just stories.
Amazing.
You could actually plan, considering that I am, as I've said many times, I only get one book idea at a time. You could plan that you would find an idea for your next book on book tour. So
that's amazing. The interesting thing that I heard this week was, you know, when the weather person says there's a 30% chance of rain.
Yeah.
How do you interpret that?
I'm thinking about this very carefully because I ask this a lot of my phone, or I get my daughter to ask Alexa, and generally, I don't think about it much, but if it's 50% or more, I assume I'm going to get wet. Tell me what it means.
I thought if a 30% chance of rain, it's not likely to rain, that it's 70% no rain. But 30% chance of rain means it's going to rain, but there's a 30% chance the area that you are in will get that rain.
What? How
Isn't
did you
that
find this
weird?
Out?
Weird. Twitter.
Are you on there?
I then double verified. Well, I'm looking for housewives. Real housewives.
Have they not moved to Threads?
I haven't moved to Threads. So maybe they all have migrated across, hence why I'm now on Terrain content. But I Googled it and it's in fact true. So when there's a percentage chance of rain, there is rain. It just is around the area that it falls on.
I suppose that works to my point that you're not necessarily going to get wet. I mean, when I look for the rain,
that's true.
Generally, I mean, sometimes of the year I'm thinking about whether I need to water the garden, but generally I'm thinking, do I need an umbrella or not?
Yeah.
Okay, that's
so
blown
my
mind.
So maybe it's a similar thing. We'll see. Mm. I love that. Well, it's good you've got a notebook handy or the notes app on your phone.
The notes app on my phone is not working for some reason. So I just send myself messages, also deeply problematic. Anyway, book tours. I thought that I would give some key pointers about the book tour because I've been getting some lovely messages. It's been all over social media, as people who follow me will know. And I've been getting some lovely messages, which I'm going to take in the spirit I think they've been asked, which is, whoa, can I have your publicist, etc.? I'm going to address that and assume that they've been asked in that way and not in a, you bitch, you got a big book tour, which is also fine if that is the way. But I thought that I would talk about it because the book tour that you see or that people see is not necessarily all the work of my dear publicist, who is amazing at my publishing house. And here are some key pointers about that, which people may or may not find useful. I hope they find useful. My publicist at SNS currently has 17 campaigns that she is looking after.
Wow.
Yeah, 17. So that might not be the same at other people's publishing houses, but that gives you an indication of kind of what your publicist may be juggling for listeners. And so I reckon probably 50% of the tour, this is all very loose, I have not got real data on this, possibly 50% of the tour has been set up directly through requests to the publicist and her organizing them. And the other 50% is myself and our beautiful Jill, whom I pay to do this for me. And to go back to the start, the first thing I did, which people, I don't know, I don't remember if you did this or got asked to do this, but sometimes your publisher will say, okay, the book's coming up. Have you got ideas or what do you want to do? Did you have to do that?
Yes, I think I did both times, yeah. But I don't think I had a lot to contribute.
Well, but also we get more as we go along, right?
So yes, this is my third book.
We get more as we go along. So I put together a long list of booksellers I had relationships with or that I'd visited before or events that I wanted to do.
It's not true. Now that I think back, there were things that I said, oh, I'd like to do this or I would like to do that.
Yeah, I'd like to do this thing. I had very clear idea about what I wanted to do for that Melbourne launch, the trades hall and all that stuff. So that was all, I put that down at the start. Then eventually we had a meeting about it, the publicist and I, about what might work and what wouldn't fit into budget. And then I decided that I would also pick up some additional things myself and pay for them. So, travel for the next bits of the tour aren't necessarily covered by the publisher. And that's a tricky thing, right? Because I'm not having to take time off paid work, although I have taken time off I've taken leave from uni. So that is taking time off paid work because that's my scholarship. But there was a really interesting article or Substack from Alicia Kennedy, who's a US writer, a food writer who's just released a book called No Meat Required. I'm not actually sure if it's available here, but her Substack's great. And she said this, which I will quote and we'll put a link into this. She said, book promotion requires a lot of time and mental work that's unpaid as well as unpaid writing work. This is fine. It's marketing. But if the newsletter weren't here, if I weren't receiving the last piece of my tiny advance plus a few checks from work done months ago that are trickling in, this would have been disastrous for me. Publishing is an industry that takes for granted the financial privilege of its workers and authors alike. That's built into its design. End quote. I mean, that's all stuff that we have talked about many, many times. But there is an element where, and we've talked about this, remember when Ian McGold and Jack Heath and Karen Viggers right at that very,
that
very,
at the very
first
start. I think about that a lot, actually.
Yeah, thing that we did. They said, I think all of them, is this right, that they put aside some of their advance as an investment for what they would pay for publicity and marketing when it came up to that?
From memory, I think Jack Heath was at that time, and opinions change and blah, blah, blah. I thought he was critical of that was, I don't know if those guys did it, but I think he was sort of saying, like, what precedent does that set?
Yes.
Is it a shifting of responsibility to
from
companies to individuals?
Yeah, which it totally is. But also,
well, it's just not a profitable enough industry.
It's not a profitable enough industry.
This is like the fundamental conundrum.
Yeah.
So it's interesting you're saying some of this because was it you that recommended the most recent episode of Secrets from the Green Room, which is with Emma Gold and Karen Viggers?
Yes.
Did you recommend that on the last episode?
Was it that one? I recommended definitely the one with about the bookshops.
Okay. Well, in their most recent is an interview with Chris Flynn, and he also organised a book tour, and I think Emma Gold talks about doing the same thing, organising a book tour, maybe part with the publisher and part self-tour. But what's so interesting about him talking to it is that it sounds like he kind of couples the book tour and events with looking at Nielsen BookScan and kind of matching up how do sales, like what is the relationship between the things that I'm doing in this book tour, the places that I'm going, the types of events with whether book sales increase
Yeah.
And is it worth the effort, basically?
Is it worth the effort? And I think that you have to decide that because it's big, right? Like it's a lot of work. But I think that, you know, and I love it. And that's also personality based. This is something that I love, that I have the privilege of doing because, you know, I can take this time out and the village hustles to help me out at home. But it is still work. It's work. Yes. And you want it to translate into sales. I mean, we wouldn't be doing it. I certainly wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't translating into sales of the book.
Well, one of the cool things he mentions that is not a point that I'd heard before was that, so his book that did really well is Mammoth. It came out during the pandemic and right at the start of the pandemic, almost before books were pulled. It was like really sort of as the pandemic happened. It did really well. But in his analysis, he talks about the sales was driven by regional sales, not by city bookshops. So his thing is sort of the book tour that takes you out of the city, you know, kind of taps into that market a bit more, whereas the city-based bookshops are maybe a bit more saturated with visits and authors and events and those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Great point.
I think that that's a really good point. And, you know, I have taken a leaf from that book, both Chris's and Irma's, and that very first, we've talked about this before, I remember watching Holly Ringland with Lost Flowers do that tour down the East Coast and thinking that looks good. And for instance, the little tour that I'm doing after Ride Around the Murray on the weekend of the 15th to 17th, and then I'm going down through
September. So coming right up. Listeners.
Coming right up. And then I'm going up to Boorowa and then down to Huskisson and to Maruya and to Tathra and then home. And in that little bit, there's four events and there's maybe another six bookshop visits. Those bookshops don't necessarily get visiting authors all the time. There's amazing, great local authors who live in that area, but they don't necessarily have events all the time. Mm. And they were all like, yes. But I think there's some key things too. And I was thinking back, I actually checked in with Ian Ryan, who we've spoken to before on the podcast, he of the Taylor Swift theory. He's also got a new book coming out next year with Ultimo Press called The Strip, which I'm very excited to read. And I really remembered him saying that when you're setting up events in music industry, which is where he comes from, and you're talking to venues, the key thing to do is have as much of the plan for the possible pitch for the event already sorted. So you say, yes, in bookshop land, I can just chat. I can do a chat with a bookseller. I can find a local person who will do this with me. We can be there on this day. I've got this much social reach. We can advertise it here. For instance, with a lot of those bookshop events, I got Jill to do the kind of media things for them, tiles for socials, et cetera, so that wasn't an additional thing that the bookshops had to do. So if you are thinking of pitching to bookshops possible that you can kind of say, this is how it would look. And this is the kind of reach maybe I even might have in that area.
Are a lot of those events, I mean, city-based events are often free. They're not always free. There's different arrangements. Are a lot of those regional events, do people have to buy the book to come? Is it that sort of setup?
No, none of them are a buy the book to come. Some of them are ticketed, or like a
$10
ticket, and you get wine and food. At least one of them is free. But I think the other thing on the other side for bookshops, looking at it, that most of the time, I couldn't tell the stats, but a majority of the audience will go away with one book, if not. More books. So that's something that they can bank on. I think we've talked about that other Secrets of the Green Room podcast where they spoke to the booksellers about things you need to do before you visit a bookshop. And that's to give enough lead time to make sure that they've got stock, to make sure that you turn up at an okay time. I know what I've learned from my publicist at SNS is for city bookshops, turning up any time around lunchtime is really bad form because that's when they're busiest. So you need to be either side of lunchtime. It is a better time to go. So all that stuff is really important. But they enjoy, even if they don't enjoy you coming, it's part of the work of a bookshop and of an author. Mm. So you go in, you say hello, you sign your books, you take a picture for their socials, for your socials, you know, you go on your merry way. If you're me, you chat too long, you sometimes buy a book. You don't have to do that. No one's expecting you to do that. They've got many, many authors who come in every day. The gorgeous people at Jeffrey's Bookshop, which is in Melbourne, they do an awesome thing where you write your own shelf talker when you get in.
Oh, how cool is that?
Yeah, which is very cool. So being, I reckon, up for all of that stuff, up for the things yeah. that a bookseller might well, ask Abby's you to do.
Bookshop in Sydney always make you do a pitch that they yes. record for their social media, which is like,
exactly.
God, I would never look at that pitch. But
No, I did not cool think about that. And that's another thing for, you know, for writers who are going about doing this stuff, have a look what people expect. If you go to The Leaf and the gorgeous Katie there, you'll know that you're going to do a chat to camera when you do that, which is amazing. They've got that beautiful wall of all the authors' faces. So, you know what might be expected in certain places as well. I think that that's really important to know. I have now got the figures for you, Catherine. So I've done or I'm
How
doing.
How did that happen? What do you mean you just now got the figures?
I just now.
Between starting.
Or between yeah, because Jill sent them through to me because I had asked because I don't even know what I'm doing. This is how good Jill is. I've got 26 events and 29 bookshops. So often.
26 events.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And some of those are at festivals. So on festivals, oh my gosh, I've just seen, you might've seen this come up this week. So this is from Anna Featherstone, who's a writer, big kind of industry person in terms of, self-publishing.
Yes, I follow her on Instagram. Does
a lot of great advice. And she's recently published, an article, which we'll link to, on how to get invited to speak at a writer's festival. It's got some really fabulous tips in there. You know, she really, Anna really knows her stuff. The funniest part, the most enjoyable part is that she's talked to Joe Canham from Blarney Books, who runs the Port Ferry Literary Weekend. And Joe's given her some definite what not to do tips in terms of getting invited to a writer's festival. And the first one, which is very funny, Joe says, don't be the dude who rings up and tells the organizer they've omitted the best writer in Australia. True story. That will guarantee you will remain on the no invite list. So I think the other thing to remember.
I think that the best new addition to the emoticons is that face where the eyes are just peeking through, like you're covering your face with your hands yeah. and the eyes are peeking through. It's so apt in this moment.
It's so apt. And I know that none of our listeners would do this, but, you know, some of the other stories I've heard on the road are, you know, authors who turn up to do their book signing. Maybe they're aware that they're the fifth or the seventh person that day. Maybe they're not. And instead of, you know, general chat, and having a look at the books and asking for recommendations from the booksellers, they just go straight in for the kill and ask, you know, how are you selling my book? What are the sales like? Wow. Like, don't do that. Don't do that. The booksellers have got thousands of books to sell. I know that our listeners would never do that, so I don't even need to say that. But, yeah, I think that idea and read the article.
You do read those lists hoping you haven't done any of the things
gosh.
Don't you? Because, like, come on, let's be honest, we all make mistakes.
But. Yeah, don't be the person. There was the same, I won't name any names, but there was the same, one of the things I heard at Jeffrey's Books was about an author who refused to write the shelf talker because they said that they'd already spent all the years writing their book and they'd written everything about it that they could.
Like, hilarious.
Don't be that person. Don't be a dick.
I love weird defiance. Like, say no.
But yeah, so book tour things, that's probably all there is to say. Just that there is an element of hustle that you need to do yourself if you want to do that yourself. If that's part of it, and if you're looking and going, oh, I want that tour, how do I get that tour? The true answer is that it's a massive combo of things. It's you know.
And you have, I think every time we have come on in the last few times, I've been like, oh, you've just gotten out of this and got out of that. But you have circled back multiple times. Like, it has not been sort of 6 weeks of.
Yeah. No.
Constant on the road.
No. There's putting the socks together in the middle of that. Anyway, welcome to Ask Questions. People can send in Ask Questions to us they want.
I do think it would be way more fun with a friend. I know you've done a lot of things with Jill as well, which probably has made it a lot more fun.
Yeah, way more fun. I do think that there is a somewhere where just find a person whose book comes out the same time as you and go with them. Like, do that. Yeah. Way more fun like that.
This episode, the featured book, is brought to you by Fremantle Press, and we are very excited to be talking to Emma Young about her novel, The Disorganization of Celia Stone. After 5 years in bookselling, Emma retrained as a journalist and has been reporting since 2011, first for community papers, then as a statewide digital journalist for WA Today. Her work also regularly appears in sister publications, The Age and The Sydney Morning Herald. Her debut novel, The Last Bookshop, was shortlisted for the inaugural Fogarty Literary Award in 2019. Welcome, Emma, to the First Time Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so exciting to be on such a wonderful and well-known podcast.
Oh, I did see, actually, side note, the Garrett got a mention in The Disorganization of Celia Stone. That felt very, I felt like I was on the inside knowledge because I had even listened to the episodes that were mentioned.
Oh, wow. We must have been, listening at the same time. Yeah, it's all very meta.
It is. Oh, it absolutely is. Let's start with the elevator pitch. What is The Disorganization of Celia Stone about?
Okay, so Celia is a financial counsellor by day. She's a writer by night, and she's trying to get her first book published. But she has a lot of balls in the air. She's trying to be a good wife, good friend, good family member, and she is trying to be a good worker and do good in the world. And only her diary basically sees what it takes to keep all that together. And so the whole book is the diary. It's a year in her life, and it's kind of the warts and all duck paddling beneath the surface. And I guess the tension comes from the day that her husband sits her down and says, I thought we were going to try and have a baby. And she's like, what? I can't fit that in. No way. But can I? And so it's her trying to figure out, how the hell am I going to do this? And she's in kind of trying to answer that question, she kind of sees a scenario in which something in her body and her mind is not working as intended, and for the first time ever, just getting more organized is not going to help her. So
it's such a good beginning to a book. It really kicks things off. Now, this is your second novel. So when did you know that you wanted to write this story, and how did you begin?
I guess I knew I wanted to do, well, it was, I had got a publishing contract for my first novel by then, and I was thinking about what to do next. And I was also coming off the back of a journey of my own with fertility issues. And when I was diagnosed with those fertility issues, I had a choice to make about how to try to make my body baby friendly, as it were, and how to try to let go. And as I kind of had to change my eating habits and had to change my exercise habits and had to really come to grips with what had led me into this place and this lifestyle that had made my body not a place that a baby wanted to hang out, I kind of started thinking, well, I grew up, you know, normal, and I was pretty normal as a 21-year-old, and I started thinking, what was it that turned me into this machine of a person rather than, and what made me into this obsessive achiever, and what was it? And so I had to kind of delve deep into figuring out what turning points in my life had led me down this kind of path of where achievement became obsessive control. And so in kind of unpacking all that and pinpointing what had started it all, I thought, oh my God, this is like the plot of a novel, tracking back through my life and thinking about what flung me into this. And that's when I thought, this could be a novel. And so I decided to turn it into one. And because I loved, I've always been like a Bridget Jones lover, and I had always, throughout this whole process, I'd been keeping diaries, and I've always loved diary novels. And so I thought, the only way that I can tell this story is to be very personal and use this. And so I kind of decided to start from there and use those diary extracts to kind of bring that story alive.
Wow. So some of the basis for this story in terms of the writing are your own diary extracts?
Yeah, some of them. Obviously, like, I kind of use that as an impetus for a first draft to kind of get things down and to get the timeline as well, and to get down those kind of milestone events along the way. Obviously, that was a beginning point. And so what happened after that was a lot of creation of characters. Pretty much all the characters are just fictionalized and fictional. A lot of the other like supporting events in the book came from the plot, from the need to move the plot along in a way that was pacey rather than the plot that had happened in my own life. However, the spirit of it and her health journey are very much based on my own diary entries.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Some of the little vignettes that you would probably laugh at the most are true.
In terms of Celia's story, she's trying to do everything right. Like this life that she's living on the surface, and certainly to an outsider, would appear super healthy and like she ticks every single box. What does organisation in Celia's life look like?
Right, so you're taken into that very early in the book. Like a lot of this got greatly condensed by my publisher because it was all very, very detailed in the beginning. But sort of in the beginning of the book, like it takes you through her kind of system that she uses for organization. So in the beginning, she's got her 2018 year in review, in which she identifies her peak positive and negative experiences, things to schedule based on her peak positives, things not to schedule based on her peak negatives. And it takes you right through kind of how she organizes her weekends. She's got to-do lists, shopping lists, and she also takes you through her productivity planner for the year, where she's got her visions, her values, her goals, her projects, her next actions for those projects, and her weekday meal plan. So it kind of sets it out all in the beginning of the book, like this is how she is going to achieve this year.
Well, there's a lot of humor in that sort of stuff too. Like it is so extreme at points.
Yeah.
One of the things that I'm always curious to see or to hear about is the career choices that writers make for their characters. Celia is a financial counsellor for a not-for-profit. What was the thought process behind making her that?
Well, it was one of the parts of kind of finding a way to tell my story that was true but also turned it into a story and not just my own life. So in real life, I'm a journalist, and I was in the events leading up to this book, I was focusing on a very urban planning and environmental round, and that was very intense, that work. And it made me very conscious of, and I did a lot of social justice journalism as well, like people in hard times. And so between environment and social justice journalism, I got very kind of beaten down by it all. And I was always very, very conscious of the 10 stories that were in my inbox that I wouldn't be able to do, and the one that was taking so long that I had to do right. And it was very high pressure. And I really wanted to get across that experience of feeling like your work is important, like that it's necessary, but also that there is too much of it for you to do as one person, and that you have to make all of these judgment calls trying to figure out who is deserving and what cause is deserving and where you're going to spend your week, knowing that the 9 other things aren't going to get done and you've got to live with that. So I was trying to find a career that kind of translated to that, and I was aware of financial counselling because, again, I had done a lot of social justice stories, and I was aware of financial counselling as a kind of career that dealt with a lot of people's problems, where there was always more need and demand than there was a service. And I knew that financial counsellors were dealing with this kind of landslide of human need in the same way that I was. And I was also able to reach out to one of those contacts of mine and interview her for a few more details about the job. So I just wanted Celia to have a kind of translatable experience, so I could talk about the experience of my job in a way that wasn't actually writing about my own job.
Interesting. So financial counsellor by day, as you said, she's a writer by night, or really a writer by extreme early morning. Yeah. In the book, Celia's writing a book. How is her approach to book writing either similar to or different from your own?
That's to the letter. So her routine in the book is mine, although I would have to say that I actually simplified it for the book. Her journey might sound overwhelming in the book, but it's simplified and shortened from the one that I went through to publish my first novel. So
in the process of redrafting, Celia strikes me as someone who would use spreadsheets, who would plan things out. Are you also someone who would use spreadsheets and, I mean, you had a diary sort of basis to begin with? What does that look like? What is that editing and refinement?
Yeah, so my diary is just my diary. It's just my journal. It's just where I, you know, get things out. And the spreadsheets, I used like kind of work tracking for my first novel and my second and third. Not that I've got the second one published yet. So, I used Word docs for a while to track, and then later I used spreadsheets. I've used Scrivener as a planning tool. I've tried all kinds of different planning tools. A lot of kind of post-its on boards getting rearranged. For Celia, I kind of had a scene-by-scene approach where I kind of got index cards. I can probably show you, actually. Although your audience can't see that, can they? So, I just had like those blue index cards where on every one I wrote a scene, what would happen in it, its function in the plot. And I would divide those into months, and that helped me, especially for this book where it's diary entries, it helped me keep like an even amount of material per month to make sure that it was realistic and that it flowed really nicely. Does that answer the question? I feel like maybe
One of the useful things about a diary is you have a plan in terms of it's 12 months, right? You have this sort of very specific time period. What is the biggest challenge in writing a diarized style story?
I guess one of them is that a diary does not normally include dialogue and reported speech, and I had to do that because, you know, that's what brings a story to life. So I had to kind of get over the fact that I felt kind of weird about it, and you have to just go, look, all diaries do this. So I looked back through my favorite diary novels and saw the way they did it and felt more confident to just include reported speech and dialogue as you would in any other book. So that was one of the major differences, I guess, the major challenges. And the other one was getting that even spread of material and that narrative kind of impetus when, like, and I wanted to keep the health timeline as it was in the book because that's quite important because there are a lot of dates that have to be hit in terms of her health journey. So I had to find a way to keep the narrative moving forward swiftly while not being able to move some events. And I really wanted this to be a really character-driven novel, and so I had a lot of material in the opening third that was establishing her character, and I had to make a lot of that ended up with a really top-heavy narrative where I had, like, you know, 50,000 words for the first 3 months of the book, and then later months were very thin. So I had to really look at a lot of the events and a lot of the character development in the opening half and make some tough decisions on whether they were necessary or whether they could be moved later and hopefully end up with something that is relatively even and flowing. But that was a lot of the fun part as well.
Yeah.
You know, that's the really kind of nerd stuff that you love.
That's true. Speaking of
once all the
stuff,
scary first draft is out of the way, that's when the fun stuff starts.
That's right. Emma, we have a lot of listeners to the show that are writers. What is either the best or the worst advice you have for writing?
Well, I guess like all the more I read about how other writers do things, the more I realize that everybody does things differently, and things that I offer up as my gospel are things that then I'll turn around and read that one another writer just never ever does that. But for me personally, I have to say that I don't edit as I go. I feel like it absolutely kills you to look around at what you did the previous day. Plus, I've never had time. To me, your aim is always to finish, and that means you've just got to draft and draft and draft until you're finished and don't look back. And I always have this kind of terrified feeling while I'm doing it, like I just have to get to the end. And yeah, and I think that if you turn around and look at how bad what you just did was, you'll never finish because you'll know that it's horrible. But you just have to know that it will be horrible and just trust that you'll look at that later and you'll deal with it later. Like, your job is to finish. So I guess that's mine.
No one published an unfinished manuscript. Yeah. That's
and I
sure.
guess don't give up, because I mean, I feel like the only difference between people who are published and people who are not is that eventually the people who are not gave up. Like, and they did not, they took a rejection as, you know, something personal rather than what it was, which is either that you've approached the wrong person at the wrong time or with the wrong thing, or that it needs more work. And if you can kind of take the emotion out of it a little bit and just treat everything as a stepping stone and just go, does this person have valid criticism, or do they just not need my work from me at this time? And if it's a criticism, then you need to incorporate it. If it's just the wrong person, place or time, and they don't really have any criticism for you, then you just need to know that you're going to put that on your spike and keep going to the next person on your list. And you just have to have that list there to go, this is not a setback, this is a step forward. So
I think that's a great reframing.
Yeah. Well, I think I got something like it from that Stephen King book on writing. He had a spike, an actual spike.
Did he? I have read that, and I don't remember
the
spike.
In his teenage bedroom, or his young man bedroom, and he would just, you know, make it like his badge of honor kind of spike and just be, which is cool. Yeah.
It is cool. I see those spikes. You don't see them as much anymore, but in cafes, and I'm always just, like, the health and safety of them really terrifies me, that I don't know that I'm going
to
get one.
But also, don't you feel like it would be satisfying to go
massively
on there? Like, I feel like that would make you feel good. Yeah.
Well, there's something,
a little violence about it that kind
yes,
of,
that's right.
You're like, I'll spike this and I'll keep going.
It's a little bit metaphoric.
Yeah.
Emma, final question. Do you have a recommendation of a debut book? It can be any genre, from any place, anytime.
Oh, I was excited to hear about this question, because I did just recently read a debut novel, and it's very, very old. It's from the 50s, but I got it here. The Heart is a Lonely Hunter by Carson McCullers, which is a book from the American South. She was 23 years old when she wrote this book, and it was her first novel, and it is now a classic writer. She was like a contemporary of the Fitzgeralds and those other kinds of writers, and her work was just stunning. Mind you, I gave it to my brother and he didn't like it at all. So
this is books,
you
though,
know,
right?
Each to his own. But I thought it was an absolute masterpiece, and I was just blown away and also horrified that this could be someone's first novel.
Yeah. That's,
those books that are devastating and inspiring in equal measure.
Yes, only a writer can say that, can't they?
Yeah, but it is just a phenomenal, phenomenal book.
Now, we are recording this just prior to the book coming out. Do you have events coming up? Where can our listeners find you?
I do. I am going to be speaking at a couple of local libraries. Hopefully I'll have a trip to Melbourne coming up. So you can sign up to my newsletter on my website, emmayoungwrites.com, if you want to be notified of a possible trip to Melbourne. Otherwise, if you're in Perth, I will be at Bull Creek Library on the 21st of September and Open Book Bookshop in Mosman Park on September 28th for In Conversation style events, where we'll be digging right into the book. So that's where you can see me.
And we will link to those in show notes. Emma Young, thanks for being on the First Time Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a podcast that I've listened to many times, so it was really exciting to be asked.
So ace.
So please, can I now tell you what I have been listening to? Because I
have been, you've been like feeding me sort of
dying,
talking this up.
So we are in our girls chat. People were looking for podcasts. One of our friends, Julia, put in this podcast and I just, you know, went, oh, not for me, and then put it on. And oh my goodness, I have now recommended it to so many people. The podcast is called Who Shat on the Floor at My Wedding? Do you know it?
I've heard of this.
Okay.
I had heard of it.
Okay, so who
shat on the floor? But also flicked past.
Yeah. Because
you've
like
piqued my interest.
Maybe not for me. So Who Shat on the Floor at My Wedding is a podcast. It's a true crime podcast. It is three women, two women, Karen and Helen, who got married in 2018. They're both British, I think, got married in 2018 in the Netherlands. Fancy wedding, 100 guests on a boat going down one of the, I don't know, canals or something. They are kind of in advertising film world. So, you know, lots of Shazam. They planned it for a long time. And at a point in the evening, somebody shat on the floor in the ladies' bathrooms.
In the ladies' bathrooms?
In a way that was clearly not accidental. So what they've done 2 years later during COVID is to bring in a friend who's also a guest at the wedding, a Kiwi woman who is very funny, Lauren Kilby, who is known throughout the podcast as the detective, to turn this into a true crime story, one in which they interview guests, where they bring in experts, where they interrogate guests. It is so good and it is so funny. Numerous of my girlfriends have been listening to this at the same time, and all we could say was that we were just cry laughing or snort laughing as we were attempting to drive, partly because it's just so funny saying who shat on the floor at my wedding, which they say many, many times. And they play it straight. So they play it.
Yeah, right. That's awesome.
They are detectives, except for the times when they just all crack up because it's way too funny. It's 13 episodes. It's 13 episodes. It's beautifully produced. Like they've got the.
They've really put the time.
You know, there. Yeah. But the funniest thing, so I didn't realize this because I was like, where did this come from? And Julia said, oh, she'd heard about it on. Bang On, Zanro and Miff Warhurst's podcast. But then I did a little bit of a deep dive before today. So it came out in 2020, did, you know, reasonably well, but it wasn't breaking any kind of records. And then someone tweeted about it at the start of this year. One tweet went viral. They have been like, it's gone off. They've been offered a TV show. There's a movie. They're doing a second season. Like,
what
just
are you doing a second season about?
Well, because what they asked during it is if you have a similar mystery that you would like investigated by our crack team of interrogators.
Gold.
It's just if you need a laugh, I guarantee you will laugh. Who shat on the floor at my wedding? It's very, very good.
Oh my God, I want to like terminate this chat and
don't terminate the chat. Tell me, what have you been listening to?
Well, not a heap, actually. I just was going to mention that Secrets from the Green Room podcast. But in terms of reading, I went to RWR, which is Rob McDonald's Happy Millions birthday launch on the weekend. This is a picture book. So good. Do you know anything about this book?
No, please tell me. I've been trying to work out what the millionth birthday is about. I'm very excited.
Such a gorgeous, gorgeous concept. I actually remember him mentioning it probably 18 months ago, something like that. But the starting point for the story is it's Wolf's fifth birthday, and he wishes, as he blows out the candles on his cake, that every day could be his birthday. Mm-hmm. And so every day becomes his birthday. It's really cool. And obviously things, you know, you can't have infinite number of birthdays without people tiring of it being your birthday, but it's got a great twist at the end. I so recommend it if you are on the hunt for a little kid's book. Perfect for a birthday or for any day. It's a good one.
I love that. That's so good. And tell me about the launch because it looked super fun.
Oh, the launch was great. It was at the Younger Son, which is the son in Yarraville's kids bookshop. I hadn't been there before. Super cute bookshop. He actually didn't read the book himself. He had someone else read it who was dressed up in a super fun way. There were games for kids and things to be won and all the rest of it. Oscar actually decorated a kids party hat, and Oscar won the prize for the best kids party hat. But there was cake.
Cool, Oscar.
It was really cute. The book is published by Larrikin Press, and the head guy of Larrikin Press was there. I didn't catch his name. But he said something about the fact that their philosophy with books, and particularly with kids' picture books, is that the books should be fun and they don't have to have a message. And this is a book that is in that Roald Dahl a bit ilk of just being super fun and not being kind of perfectly correct at all times.
I love that. I have been reading. I've read, in fact, I just finished this morning and I enjoyed it so much, a book that we mentioned last week because you are going to launch it in Melbourne, Claire Fletcher's Love Match. It's so great. Oh, I loved
it. I'm halfway through. Yeah. I picked it up too early. I'm kind of kicking myself because normally I'd,
yeah, you've got to get closer. The timing right.
I've timed it terribly. Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
Yeah, and just that fun. I want fun right now. And it is fun and smart, and it says some smart things and things.
So
that,
it's a kind of like a romantic comedy set in a small town around a young woman, she's in her 20s, who joins a rugby team. But what I love about it is that Maeve Binchy type thing of this world existing, and so characters from previous books.
Yes.
This character.
Yeah, there's a link to Five Bush Weddings, the previous book, and to a number of characters, especially the gorgeous Mabel and her additional kind of the other narrative about her past and the vintage dresses and outfits, all of that stuff. I really loved it. Great, great rural romance or whatever we call it. Very clever.
Super, super positive. Something nice about reading things where you know everything's going to be okay.
Everything is going to be okay. The other one that had left me with all the good feels is that I am one of the casquillion people who have been reading the new Ann Patchett.
I knew you were going to say that as you were doing the lead in. I had this on my list too.
Mm-hmm. Tom Lake, it is so good. It is so good, partly because Patchett is so good. And I think you have that feeling when you go into this book right from the very first line that you are just in the hands of someone who knows exactly what they are doing, how to tell a story, how to give you the feels in the right spot. She's so damn good at her craft.
Yeah.
So Tom Lake is the story of Lara and her three daughters who have come home during COVID to work on the family's cherry farm. And as they're doing that, Lara is telling the story of one summer when she had a fling with a man who becomes a very famous movie star. And it is so beautiful. And it has at its core, and I think Ann Patchett talks about this in a recent episode of The Book Show, with Claire Nichols, there's another text at its center, which is this play called Our Town, which is evidently very famous in the US, but I wondered if it was
a real play, actually.
Yeah. And evidently Ann Patchett reads it every year. So you can tell, it's in her DNA because of the way she knows it. Just, yeah, very beautiful, beautiful book.
Interesting. Because it sort of has a dual timeline in many ways. You've got the present day where she's telling the story, and then you have the story that's unfolding. I do think it's a case of the past story being sort of outshining the present day story. And almost like halfway through, I was like, do you need the present day story? But then there are some beautiful moments in the present day story that I wouldn't want to lose.
Yes. But
for that reason, I reckon it's a good club book.
Yes.
Even like a writer's book club book, because I think there's a bit you could chat about and debate in the kind of the way it's been stitched together.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way that the omissions that Lara makes as the narrator of the story, in which parts of the story she tells when and why she does. That's, I thought that was very, very clever. I would like, did you read it in book form or listen to it?
Kindle. I read it in ebook. Yeah.
Because apparently the audiobook is stunning and Meryl Streep does it. So there you go.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Right.
I also, it is a book that had, I recalled a book I read last year that was, I didn't finish it. I won't say what it was, but it was around protest, environmental protests and those kinds of things. And I wasn't really that engaged with it. In Tom Lake, she has a particular scene where that talks to, they're on a cherry farm, so talks to the impact of climate change on not so much the farm, partly the farm, but also just the next generation's lives. Mm. And it's so sort of impactfully done, mm. like it just really kind of punches you in the gut. And I sort of really thought about how much harder it is to be impactful in a book that is all about climate change,
yeah.
versus just to kind of come sideways at it in a moment in a book, yeah. that's completely about something else.
Yeah.
She did that so well.
Yeah, totally does that so well. I concur completely. I have to ask, because you just mentioned something we don't talk about often, which is not finishing books. And I wrote about the overwhelm of my TBR pile last week for my newsletter. And then went on to be in a couple of bookstores where I was asking the booksellers, like, how do you deal with your TBR piles? What do you read next? And these two wonderful booksellers, who I won't name because I didn't get permission to share this story, but they were talking about the fact that when new books come in, they just write their the name of the book on a slip of paper and they put it into a jar, and then they just randomly select what new book they're going to read, which to me was mind-blowing, because, like, how do you know you're in the mood for that thing? But anyway, they both swore by it as a way to get through the books. But also they were very big supporters of not finishing, the old DNF, which I find really hard.
I cannot finish. Yeah.
To do, although I say that.
And I can, like, also pick up after a month.
Yes, so, like, exactly.
I can come back to it after a long break.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. Yeah.
A random one I wanted to mention, I'm hoping I haven't mentioned this already. It's called The Big Year, A Tale of Man, Nature and Fowl Obsession, fowl being the bird version of fowl. The author is Mark Obmasik. That's a hard name to say. It's a book about birding. So in America, they have a thing called the Big Year. That's where the title of the book comes from. And basically it's a competition among birders. They say birders, not twitchers, but bird watchers. It's this, you do it across a calendar year and you have to see how many birds you can see in America within the year. It's not like a casual stroll around, there's a magpie type thing. You have to haul ass for the whole year to see as many birds as you can. There's normal birds that you see that are native to America, but if you want to win, you have to see quite a lot of rare birds. And so rare birds are birds that are not native to North America, but they might have blown off course, or someone just might randomly have a bird feeder in their backyard and realize, oh, there's some Asian finch sort of feeding out of this bird feeder. So then they'll alert birders, and birders will start coming just to see this really rare bird to try and get their numbers up. It's completely fascinating. It basically follows these three guys who are obsessed and are all trying to win the Big Year birding competition. They've all got, like, very different personalities. I've since found out that it's been made into a movie, and Jack Black is one of the birders, and you could kind of, even though I don't know, I can definitely pick which birder Jack Black is. There's one in particular who kind of defies all the etiquette. But it's such a cool, weird book. There's all this stuff, like, they go birding on quite an obscure island, and you're basically, you can't leave the island. You pick a week and you can go for a week, and there's sort of peak seasons and stuff to go. But the way that the etiquette around seeing birds is, if a bird is seen, all the birders will go and try and get to where the bird is. They line up in a queue, and so very tense if you're at the back of the queue because the bird might go. But basically you might have a telescope, like whatever the thing is that you look through that's all set up, the first person will look, they get like a couple of seconds to sight the bird, and then they go to the back of the queue. So they all get a quick look. The first run through of the line is just a quick look so that they can mark the bird off their list. And then once they've all sighted the bird, then the queue starts again and they can have a longer look at the bird. It's so
okay, I have questions. What is the officialdom in relation to this? Like, how does someone help to see you sight a bird?
It's like there's one of the guys that is like super competitive and flouts the rules. The one thing that he always does is make sure someone else is there when he sees the bird, because he's actually like, that's sort of the one, not that's not a rule, but that's the one thing he wants. He doesn't want people to kind of dispute his sightings. But there are birders that will claim to have seen birds, but they're sort of looked down upon. It's really interesting. And I think it must be in the 2000s, because one of the guys works in I think it's a nuclear power plant, on the Y2K bug, which is just weird in itself.
Oh,
and he doesn't have a lot of money, so he has to work like big hours and then bird on the weekends. I can't remember what I was going to say about him, but there's sort of all of these kind of personal stories woven in.
How did this book come into your orbit?
The book came into my orbit because I'm working on the second middle grade book, and the thing about sewage treatment plants and towns attached to sewage treatment plants is the bird life. Like, you have amazing bird life at treatment plants. So I'm looking at like birding.
Have you talked to Bird Michael from Twitter?
No, I haven't. This is the thing about the loss of Twitter, because Angela Savage used to post a lot about birds as well. Yes. So I'm hoping to hunt her down.
I feel like you need to go birding with Angela Savage and Bird Michael from Twitter. You need to set that up, because they have been to the sewage plant and done.
Yeah, exactly. No, I should. I'll start stalking them. It's a cool thing. And they sort of also talk about, it's a journalist that has written the book, and it's done such a good job. But just what a nice sense of community to be among other birders, even though it's competitive, because everybody else thinks it's just a weird, lame thing to be doing.
We talked before on here about that rumor that Jonathan Franzen only ever goes to writers' festivals because he's a birder. And so,
I've never heard of that.
Yeah. In case you want to add this into your middle grade story. Apparently, I don't know where I got this from, but I think I've heard it many times, is that Franzen is a very big birder. I mean, I think that's one of the things in one of his books, Freedom.
Right.
And so when he comes to, when he gets invited to another country, it is kind of reliant on the birding trip that he can do at the same time to tick whatever he needs to.
It is a hilarious sport. Like, they're quite, very intense.
Can you just dive in there just to give us a little update on how you're going with the reading, drawing, editing of the middle grade books?
I'm in the editing process, which is my favourite part of the process. They're very good on timing and all the rest of it, but I've just struggled finding time. Normally I can kind of carve out, we might have a writer's retreat or might have something coming up. I've really struggled carving out time, made worse by the fact that today Carney goes away for 2 weeks on a fishing trip.
A 2 week fishing trip. Does he have a list of fish he has to catch, Catherine?
Oh, he probably does in his head. It actually started out, it's him and a friend, we're going to do one of these hardcore fishing trips where you're on a boat where you almost have to, I think you get your own bed, but it's like bunk beds wedged in the, you're sort of sleeping on top of each other and all the rest of it. And it was going to be 5 days and you don't come back in, you're sort of halfway to Indonesia. Actually, probably something you would do, really, or have
done.
Sounds
like something I would do.
But I think they've changed it now, and they're doing sort of day charters and staying at resorts and bits and pieces. It sounds pretty amazing. I mean, the fishing bit probably less so, but
yes, we started this season with your feelings about fishing, Catherine. Yes. I recall that deeply. And so how does that work at home? Things that you need, what can we help with?
It's fine. It's drop-offs and pickups.
Mm.
Like, that's the thing. You just have to be able to, do drop-offs and pickups.
Mm-hmm. I have just now filled in the forms for my big kid who is going off to high school next year for the bus, which leaves from the bottom of our street.
At what time? What time does it leave?
I don't know. Eight something. Not very. It's the local high school.
Okay, it's not very far.
It's not very far, but just the thought of that's total independence. You don't put your shoes on, or you don't find the t-shirt, or you.
Well, I think it's
the right way. You miss the bus
now. Not parking the car and walking them up, alike.
Yeah,
I park the car and say, "Get out."
What do they call it? Kiss and run, kiss and go,
kiss and run,
whatever it's called.
Yeah.
Good luck, my friend.
Yeah, no. Oh.
Will you be watching anything this fortnight?
The only thing I'm watching at the moment, sadly, because it's just from a lack of Housewives shows, is The Real Housewives of New York, which is a long-running Housewives, but was sort of fledgling. Is that the word?
Yeah.
Not going so well. So they got rid of all of the Housewives, and now they have a new batch of Housewives, and they've done so damn well in the recruitment of the new batch of Housewives. I'm 1,000% into it. There's this one woman, Jenna Lyons. I don't know if you've heard of Jenna Lyons. I only had heard of her from a previous reality TV show, but she worked for J. Crew, which is like a clothing brand, started out in the lower levels, worked her way up to becoming like president of that very successful fashion brand. But she would like dress the Obamas, like they sort of talk about her as having dressed half of America. So she's like the best inclusion, but she also has this rare genetic condition that impacts things like she doesn't grow eyelashes. Of course, now she has an eyelash business. Fake eyelashes, but she has sort of like really major teeth issues. Like when you look at her, it looks like she has normal teeth, but she's had lots of surgeries. And she has a surgery in last week's episode. I'm very finely attuned to teeth trauma. But she's such a good inclusion on the show because she has this amazing contrast of this aspirational housewife lifestyle stuff, but then she has this sort of story that is just part of a bigger, more interesting story about her. Related to this genetic condition.
Maybe when you need a break from your current building and planning watery things, you should get into recruitment for Housewives.
Oh my God, I'd love it.
You would be so good.
Oh my God, I would love it. Do you know though, I have been going down, that's the other listen that I've had. I am now listening to, there's a well-known Housewives podcast called Two Teas in a Pod. They probably do 3 episodes a week. It's not enough for me. Now I'm listening to these podcasts that are raging fans that just discuss the absolute minutiae of Housewives. And I am listening to episodes that are like 3 years old. Like okay.
Catherine, we need it's to, I think we need listen. To talk need about to, this.
I need to listen to the You Shat at My Wedding one.
Yeah. Okay. Do that. And then we'll talk about it. Maybe we can get you to guest on one of those shows just you know, to get it out there. Cause I know I do not provide you with the kind of repartee of housewife content. Perhaps listeners, maybe we should get in a guest. Another, if you are a listener who watches Housewives as much as Catherine does, can you please let us know? Because maybe you can come and sit in my seat and engage with her on this.
They are coming out of the woodwork because some of my featured book interviews, Elise Esther Hurst and Robin Dennison, probably spent more time talking about Housewives than the actual interview.
That's it. Next season, we're not talking about books. We're only talking about Housewives. You
should, it's like being like a rabid football fan or something, like only that's slightly more socially acceptable. Well, a lot more socially acceptable.
But all right. We accept everyone here.
What have you been watching?
Oh, we got to the end of season 2 of Ted Lasso. Yeah. And
how do you feel? Do you want, like, how do you feel about Ray and
I have many feelings. I have so many feelings on everything. The girls were shattered on a number of levels by many things. I want to keep watching, but we have been warned that season 3 is maybe not as feel good by you and other people.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we'll continue on that. What I thought was extraordinary was some of the kind of risks that they took in terms of like that whole random trip episode where Beard just goes out on the town for the night. Amazing. Yes. And then also, which I did not realize,
the character, trying, but not a great, it's a bit
not
like
a great episode.
No, but I, good on you for doing something weird. Yeah.
Yes. And then I also deep dived on that and realized I didn't realize that the character, that the actor who plays Roy Kent is one of the executive producers, and he wrote that episode.
Oh. Oh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But also the way that they did the cuts. No spoilers for people who haven't watched it. Yeah, but the way they deal with the funerals in the last episode of season two and the kind of bigness of that emotion and, you know, Ted finally being able to talk about his past, I just thought it was so beautifully done. I was like, that is very, very, very good television. So
even the Nate, the arc of Nate and the seeding of Nate early is like perfection.
Perfection. Perfection. Yeah. Really I will be good. Watching season three. Not sure if the girls are going to watch it with me. They're loving it. Just not sure if I have to watch it first. But, yeah, great television. Love it.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.